Good evening, my name is Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric.
A very sleepy alcoholic. The house has been crazy, but in a good way. I never thought I'd be starting a basketball team with regards to children. In active alcoholism, and even before I picked up my first drink, I couldn't really much afford to take care of myself rather than have the privilege and honor to support and provide for a family. So I thank God for AA, and I thank AA for God. I'm going to touch back a little bit on the fifth step, kind of wrapping that up from last week. So we're going to start on page 72. It says, having made a personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and discover the obstacles in our path. We had admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. This requires action on our part, which, when completed, will mean that we have admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects. This brings us to the fifth step in the program of recovery mentioned in the preceding chapter. So, it's a three-sided triangle, right? There's a trinity here, unity, recovery, and service, and there's also a trinity within the fifth step. God, myself, and another human being. It wouldn't be as embarrassing, I guess, to admit these things to God directly without another human being present. That would be easy. I've done that many times, even claiming to be a non-believer. It's funny how I claim atheism, but I always would have a conversation with something I didn't believe in when times got tough in my life. This is all 2020 hindsight. Looking back on it now, that's why inventory for me is very important. Uncover, discover, and discard the flaws in my makeup that have been blocking me from that relationship with God. So it says, "In this is perhaps difficult, especially discussing our defects with another person. We think we have done well enough in admitting these things to ourselves. There is doubt about that. In actual practice, we usually find a solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary to go much further. We will be more reconciled to discussing ourselves with another person when we see good reason why we should do so. The best reason first, and this is a big reason, right? If we skip this vital step, vital, and Bill uses the word vital. So when I go to the doctor, they check my vital signs, and vitals are necessary for life, right? And so for me, this is a necessary for life. We may not overcome drinking. That's a big reason why, right? I'm only as sick as my secrets. Time after time, newcomers have tried to keep to themselves certain facts about their lives. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wonder why they fell. We think the reason is they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves, but they had not learned enough humility, fearlessness, and honesty in the sense we find it necessary, again, necessary, until they told someone else all their life story. In reality, when I look at that last part here, all my life story, just an inventory for me was insufficient. Just doing a four-step was insufficient. Just doing the resentment inventory, the sex inventory, the harms and the fears was insufficient because I left out of that inventory chunks of my life. And one of the first assignments I got from my sponsor was to write an autobiography. And he wanted me to do an increments of age, 0 to 5, 5 to 10, and so on and so forth until current time. And I had no idea why I was writing that autobiography, but I was completely crushed by my alcoholism, and all my scorecards were at zero. So I was actually willing to do something that maybe I didn't want to do or didn't care to believe in, but there was no resistance. And I think I spoke about that last week, you know, that change doesn't have to be painful, but the resistance to change can be very painful. So when I resist the program of recovery as an alcoholic, it can be very painful for me to resist the suggestions. If I could do it my way, I wouldn't be here. My way gets me drunk or high or whatever substance is on the table. Really, for me, it didn't matter. Alcohol was always there, but there was always other stuff on top of the alcohol. And I look at our steps, too, and the only step that covers this substance is step one. That's the only step that talks about alcohol. The truth is, I'm powerless over alcohol because I'm powerless over my life, and I'm powerless over my feelings and emotions. In fact, it talks about that back on page 52, and talks about my bedevilments. Mm-hmm. And my negative emotions, right? It says, I'll read this real quick. It says, we had to ask ourselves, why should we apply to our human problems the same readiness to change our point of view? We were having trouble with personal relationships. Absolutely. Upon inventory and looking at this, it's funny, my sponsor came up with a syndrome for me in high school because I couldn't possibly have trouble with personal relationships. I was popular. Right, I can. I'm a chameleon because people are my higher power. I want you to like me, right? So I had a syndrome called friends with everyone and close to no one, arm's length, because I'm deeply insecure and I'm full of fear. And if you knew anything about me that I knew about me, you'd feel about me the way I felt about me, and that wasn't very good. So friends with everyone and close to no one, arm's length. I had abandonment issues because of my father disappearing when I was 5 years old, and I didn't realize that, but that's why it was hard for me to have personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional nature, absolutely. Either I'm way up here and I'm all on top of the world, or I'm dirt beneath your feet. I had no middle ground. My emotional nature would swing, and I didn't understand that, right? We were prey to misery and depression. Well, I seemed like I was happy on the outside. But on the inside, the need for validation for other people made me miserable and unhappy, right? I couldn't make a living. I did make a living in high school because I was afraid of being broke like my mother and being on welfare, so I had two jobs in high school. I was a workaholic. I was afraid of not being able to make a living growing up, because of me growing up in a single-parent home. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We could not seem to be a real help to other people. Was not a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. So that's my alcoholism in a nutshell, in that paragraph. And that's why I seek relief from the sinkhole life, which is supposed to be a gift, because I'm struggling with all these things on the inside, right? And I got to tell somebody about this stuff, because if I don't get it out, it's going to kill me. And I heard somebody use an analogy about walking with a backpack full of bricks through my life. And growing up as a young man, I would just pick up little pieces of these bricks, and I'd put them in my backpack, and life would get very heavy, and then I would begin to do things that I wasn't proud of, due to my use and abuse of alcohol and drugs. Things I said I was never going to do, right? The unacceptable becomes acceptable, because as I spoke about a couple weeks ago, I rationalized my right to drink because it's the only solution I have to life on life's terms. Because when I take a drink, it does something for me that I cannot do for myself. The fear goes away. The anxiety goes away. And I feel like I'm a part of the human race at last, right? So going back to page 73. And this kind of ties in with the bedevilments, right? It talks about more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. Absolutely. I am who I want you to be. I am who I think you want me to be. I kind of fit the mold, right? I was I was in a chess club. I hung out with the jocks. You know, I hung out with every group, every clique in high school, just to try to feel a part of. And so I was one way with one group of people. I was another way with another group of people. And I really had no identity. My identity was wrapped up in the validation of what you thought of me. Mm. You know? And they say when you take the alcoholic out of the alcoholic, you're left with the ick. And my whole life was based upon trying to treat that ick. And I've been trying to do it for a long time. He is very much an actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. Reputation and status is another higher power. The inconsistencies is made worse by the things he does on his sprees. Coming to his senses, he's revolted at certain episodes he vaguely remembers. These memories are a nightmare, another brick in the backpack, right? A nightmare. I picked up many nightmares. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. It talks about the four horsemen. And I woke up with those things every time I came to from a drunk, right? He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. He hopes they will never see the light of day. He is under constant fear and tension. That makes for more drinking. Absolutely. And so the cycle goes. I have a sobriety problem. Because really my problem, my emotional nature and all that stuff I talked about, they talk about on page 52, comes up in between drinks. And that's why the time in between drinks as I go on into my active alcoholism gets shorter and shorter and shorter. Because I just can't seem to bear life without alcohol. Mm-hmm. It's too difficult. It's heavy. I need help. You know? And I don't have any other solution but to pick up a drink or a drug and do it all over again and add to that load on my back by going out and doing some miserable things. You know, I talked about the abuse the couple of weeks I was here. You know, that's something that I thought I was taking to my grave. I never was going to talk about that to anybody. I was in my 20s. I was allowing a man to sexually abuse me because I needed crack cocaine and alcohol. I couldn't live without it. So I wasn't always a victim. Sometimes I was a volunteer. And it was hard for me to admit that. Right? Decisions based on self would later put me in a position to be hurt. And so it goes on and on and on. And it's really difficult to break that cycle once I take that first drink. I got to say, if I were to take a drink today, I'd be right back in that place all over again. That physical allergy never leaves me. It's been, on October 2nd, by God's grace and mercy, I was able to celebrate 9 years. Today is my 21st, today is my birthday, not 21st, but my 38th birthday. I wish. I'm getting old.
Birthday.
I have a 1-week-old at home, a 14-month-old, an 8-year-old, and 2 little yap-yap dogs. Life is full. Life is busy. And I'm free because I was willing to talk about that stuff with another human being. You know, it's amazing. We're only as sick as our secrets. Right? So I'm going to skip back to the last paragraph here. It says, psychologists are inclined to agree with us. We have spent thousands of dollars for examinations. We know but few instances where we have given these doctors a fair break. We have seldom told them the whole truth, nor have we followed their advice. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. Small wonder many in the medical profession have a low opinion of alcoholics and their chances for recovery. Mm. And so honesty is a big component of me and my freedom and my recovery, right? Says we must, not says we suggest. Says we must be entirely honest with somebody if we expect to live long or happily in this world. Rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. Those of us belong to a religious denomination which requires confession must, and, of course, will want to go to the proper appointed authorities whose duty it is to receive it. Though we have no religious connection, we may still do well to talk with someone ordained by an established religion. We often find such a person quick to see and understand our problem. Of course, we sometimes encounter people who do not understand alcoholics. If we cannot, or would rather not do this, we search our acquaintances for a close-mouthed, understanding friend. Perhaps our doctor or psychologist will be the person. And it may be one of our own family. Not a good idea. they're talking about this when this book was written back in the 30s, the late 30s. Sponsorship wasn't truly formed yet. You know, they didn't have 1,500 meetings a week to go to back then. So they had to find other people to hear their alcoholic problem, right? We are so blessed in AA today that my closed-mouth person was my sponsor, who is still my sponsor today, right? So they didn't have that back then. And I made the mistake of doing a ninth step with my ex, my 14-year-old daughter, prior to getting to the ninth step. And what I really did with her was a mini fifth step. And I unfolded some information on her that she had no business knowing. You know, it also talks about, further down, speaking to somebody who will be unaffected. And certainly a family member, if I've hurt them, and I try to go tell them my situation, would probably be affected, right? But we cannot disclose anything to our wives, right, or our parents, which will hurt them and make them unhappy. I didn't read that part when I did that the first time, right? We have no right to save our own skin at another person's expense. Such parts of our story will tell to someone who will understand yet be unaffected. The rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. So notwithstanding the great necessity for discussing ourselves with someone, it may be one who is so situated that there is no suitable person available. If that is so, this step may be postponed. Rationalizing alcoholic will say, postponement, how long is that, right? not too long. Only, however, if we hold ourselves in complete readiness to go through with it at the first opportunity. We say this because we are very anxious that we talk to the right person. It is important that he be able to keep a confidence, that he fully understand and approve what we are driving at, that he will not try to change our plan, but we must not use this as a mere excuse to postpone. When we decide who is to hear our story, we waste no time. We have a written inventory, and we are prepared for a long talk. We explain to our partner what we are about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. Most people approached in this way will be glad to help. They will be honored by our confidence. And these are a great set of promises. And these are the fifth step promises. You know, I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and some of them call them the 12 promises. What they're really reading is that those are the ninth step promises, right? And I read the third step promises, I think, a week ago or 2 weeks ago. These are the fifth step promises. In fact, there are promises throughout this book. There's also warnings. We just read a warning. If I skip on the step, there's a good chance I will drink again if I withhold something, right? And so the one thing that keeps me from telling somebody everything, and it says it right here, what do I have to pocket? I have to pocket my pride. Pride precedes the fall. And when I'm afraid of what you're going to think about me, again, you're my higher power. And I've lost contact with God. So what am I going to do? I'm going to pocket my pride. I pocket my pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. Once I have taken this step withholding nothing, I am delighted. I can look the world in the eye. I can be alone at perfect peace and ease. My fears fall from me. I begin to feel the nearness of my Creator. I may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now I begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often come strongly. I feel I am on a broad highway, walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. That's a powerful paragraph, right? And withholding nothing, when I did this, I felt that way. Atheism and all that stuff, I kind of sorted all that out and my resentment against organized religion, and I probably shared about it last week, but, you know, it had nothing to do with the good men and women of organized religion. It was an ego-feeding proposition to put somebody else down because I was deeply insecure with myself. It had nothing to do with organized religion. It was all in me and my perception of, you know. And so I had another set of instructions after, you know, purging all this information. And so he told me to do this. It says, returning home, I find a place where I can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what I have done. I thank God from the bottom of my heart that I know Him better. Taking this book down from my shelf, I turn to the pages which contains the 12 steps, carefully reading the first 5 proposals, which are the 5 steps. Right? I ask if I had omitted anything, for I was building an arch through which I shall walk a free man at last. Is my work solid so far? Are the stones properly in place? Have I skimped on the cement put into the foundation? Have I tried to make mortar without sand? And so that's what I did. I went home for an hour, and I sat, and I pretty much cleaned house. Everything was out. It's funny, too, because when I talked to my sponsor after I went and talked to my ex about so-called amends that I wasn't ready to do, I wasn't on that step yet, right? So a lot of people get sober, and they're like, oh, my God, I'm going to go tell the whole world, and I'm going to go make amends to you, and not realizing that I could possibly harm somebody by telling them information they don't need to know, right? So I did all that. And it's funny because he said, well, now, Eric, you're like an open book with her, right? He said, now you have absolutely nothing to hide. and I'm still paying for some of that information I divulged on her 9 years later. I don't know. Women never forget. Sorry. They never forget. I forget a lot of things. So I did that. I returned home. And next we go on to page 76. And we have, 2 paragraphs that cover 2 steps. It says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step 6. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. We are now ready to let God remove from us all these things which we have admitted are objectionable. Can He now take them all, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. When ready, we say something like this: My Creator, I am now willing that You should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that You now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to You and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do Your bidding. Amen. We have then completed step 7. That's it. 6 and 7. 2 paragraphs. Right? And my belief is basically 6 and 7, or 7 in itself, is 4, 5, and 6 in a nutshell. Because what I do is when I get all this information out and I take inventory, I become aware of the things that are blocking me from God, and they become objectionable. And then because I become aware of them and they're not working for me anymore and they don't have a benefit for me, I'm then willing to have God remove these defects of character, right? It's tough to live life with negative emotions. I've got to get rid of them on a daily basis. And you know, sometimes these things still crop up. So I'm really, 6 and 7 is a daily reprieve. It says it's a lifetime journey in the 12 and 12, right? Separate the men from the boys. Because these defects of character continue to pop up from time to time. Really what happens for me, the deepest root cause to any character defect that I can have today is self-centered fear. Right? I'm afraid of losing what I think I possess or not getting what I demand. Right? And really there's a deeper root cause of self-centered fear. That's lack in trust and reliance upon God. This whole book is about getting a relationship with God. God of my understanding. Right? And when my character defects crop up again, as they often do, the love of self becomes paramount over the love of God. Right? If I'm in love with self and what's going to happen for me and to me, and I'm arranging a show, I've just lost the love of God. So I need to keep focused on God's love for me. You know, you need to be God-centered, not self-centered. And both the third step and the seventh step prayer talks about removing these things from me. The third step prayer talks about to remove my difficulties so that victory over them may bear witness to those I may help with thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. So why am I asking for these difficulties to be removed? Not really for my own benefit. I mean, I get benefit out of it, right? But it's really so I can be an agent for God. So I can be freed up to help other people. And the same goes for the seven-step prayer, right? It talks about getting rid of these defects of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to God and my fellows, right? And it says something here too. It says, I offer all myself to God, both good and bad, because I'm confused, right? What I thought was good for me was bad for me. And what I think is, you know, vice versa. What I think is bad for me is really good for me, right? So I need to get rid of this warped thinking, right? And so I ask God to take everything. God is either everything or God is nothing. What's my choice to be? And quite often in my humanity, God loses his priority on my list. You know, I get so distracted by the world. You know, to be holy means to be set apart from. It doesn't mean that I'm apart from the world, but it means my attitudes and behaviors don't reflect the world's values. Right? God's value for me is the most important thing. That God's value for me is love. And God shows me unconditional love. There's nothing too worthy that he can't, nothing too dirty that he can't make worthy. Right? So I don't need to get cleaned up. A lot of people have confusion about this God business, right? They think, I need to get cleaned up before I come to God. Right? I need to be clean. I need to... But no, God meets me where I'm at. Because I can't clean myself up. I can't. If I could, I wouldn't be here. Right? So I humbly ask God to remove the defects of character. And I get reprieve. I get reprieve. And that's not God's doing. God wants them to be removed from me completely. But I get in the way of God. All the time. All the time. Right? And sometimes I carry around the negative emotions, right? And the resentment and sometimes the fear and the things that crop up because I lose that relationship for the moment. And I get distracted. And there was a guy talking about negative emotions on a Sunday, one Sunday. And he gave a really good analogy. And he talked about getting his car washed on a bright, sunny day. And he talked about going in, parking his car, going in and running some errands in the store. And coming out and seeing bird poop all over his car. He said, well, it looks nasty. It smells nasty, and if I leave it on my car long enough, the acid erodes the paint, and eats away at the metal, right?
Yep.
He said the same thing for me in my spiritual journey of life. Negative emotions are like the bird poop, right? If I hold on to anger long enough, if I hold on to resentment long enough, if I hold on to these things long enough, they erode my spiritual condition and eat away at my serenity. So I must be rid of these things. I must, or it kills me. And not a physical death, right? I remember coming to and wishing for the physical death, right? It's more like a spiritual and emotional death. Walking, like just existing on this earth, going through the motions, not really feeling connected to anything. That's the human ego at work. And the human ego has one function, and that's separation. Separation from you, separation from my family, and separation from my Creator. You know, so when I lose the love of God and I gain back the love of self, I'm in rough shape, right? But at the same time, the defects of character, the awareness of them, is really what keeps dragging me back to the need for God. If I were perfect, what need would I have for God? Right? So I need God every day, all moments of my day. Not only to come to God with my problems, the problem du jour of the day, right? This person isn't doing this, that's not going my way, blah, blah, blah. The selfishness, the self-centered prayers. But how about coming to God in thanksgiving? You know, this morning, not really waking up because I didn't really go to sleep. But, you know, changing my our son's diaper, getting peed on. It's like a little water fountain. Got to cover him quick. I should have learned that with the first boy we had, but saying, you know what, I just got peed on by a newborn. Thank you, God. Thank you. You know, and he just sits there and looks up at me. No care in the world. Imagine that. He's not trying to arrange a show. Right? He's in complete dependence and reliance upon his parents. He knows that his diaper is going to get changed. He knows he's going to get fed. He knows all these things, right? He doesn't have to go out and earn a living, right? Yeah, none of that. None of that. I think that's where my God wants me. Complete dependence and reliance. Not that it's not okay to have nice things or to have ambition, right? But my instincts, the instincts that God gave me, I overuse them. And they're the very things that drive me for relief from the thing called life, which is supposed to be a gift. Right? So, 6 and 7 is the beginning of amendable behavior. Why? Because 4 and 5, I have some awareness of my defects of character and what drives me back to the bottle or drives me to misery. And then on 6 and 7 is the beginning of amendable behavior. Because, you know, if I can't come to terms with these character defects and there's people on my resentment list, which is amazing, amazing to me that you can start off with a resentment and end up with an amends to that very person you resented. What a powerful program. Forgiveness is freedom. You know, I can, if I wanted to, I can harbor that resentment against that man who did those things to me. But what good is it? It doesn't serve any purpose for me. That anger will kill me. Right? It's amazing, right? So I actually made an amends to that man. I did. I was at a meeting. Saw him at a meeting. Watched him celebrate his 3-year anniversary. And talked to him after the meeting, and he tried to make an amends to me. I kind of wasn't having it at that point, but I threw in my mistakes in that relationship. And you know, I told him that I had apologized the way everything went worked out, you know, and that I kind of, I kind of kept it going. I kept his sickness going because I was sick. Two sickies don't make a welly, right? And so, like I said last week, when I see this man at a meeting so often, not often, but when I do, I don't have to get up and leave that meeting. Because that's who I'm not. And I'm somebody different today. And that those promises before the third step prayer, it talks about a rebirth. And people think, oh my God, I got to die, physically die and come back to life again, right? I think one of the Pharisees was talking to Jesus about that. How can I possibly be reborn, right? and he said simply, it's a new way of life. It's not about the physical flesh. It's about the attitudes and behaviors and the spiritual being inside you that drives that flesh. Right? So I had been reborn. I'm a new person. And that's a gift. Right? So it sets me up for the next two steps. Right? 4 and 5 is me getting in a relationship with me because I had no idea who I was. 6 and 7, I take that information to God. And now 8 and 9, I play nice with others, right? So that's really another trinity. There's a trinity within a trinity in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's endless trinities, actually. When you look at the way the steps are laid out and our triangle, unity, recovery, and service, it's amazing. This definitely was not a program that was written by human mind. I believe that God was a steward, and Bill was a steward, and God used Bill and Bob to come up with a program that's over 80 years old, and we get to sit in the room tonight and recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. What a gift. Thank you, God. Right? Thanksgiving. So we're going to go into steps 8 and 9. I'm not sure if I'm going to read all of it, but we'll see how far we get. We're out of time. Okay. Now we need more action, without which we find that faith without works is dead. Let's look at steps 8 and 9. We have a list of all persons we had harmed and whom we are willing to make amends. We made it when we took inventory. We subjected ourselves to a drastic self-appraisal. Now we go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. We attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask until it comes. Remember, it was agreed at the beginning we would go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. That's why timing is important with the program of recovery, because I'm the most willing when I'm new in recovery. If I hang out and marinate in Alcoholics Anonymous for long enough, my disease starts to play tricks with me. Right? I'm not drinking. I'm going to meetings. Life is getting better. Right? I got the job back. I got all this. I got all this stuff going on. And man, you know what? That thing I was going to talk about in my fifth step, maybe it's a good idea I withhold that. Right? Because I'm being deceived. The outside might be getting better by just not drinking and coming to meetings. But what about the inside? I'm still living a double life, even in AA, even making coffee, 12 locations, right? You know, on a speaking circuit. I had like 5 home groups. You know, I was a maniac in Alcoholics Anonymous in the fellowship. But nothing in God's economy is wasted, and it was exactly what I needed to be at the time. And I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change it. But there comes a point in time where not drinking and going to meetings doesn't seem to be cutting it. You know, it just doesn't fit the bill. I get whacked by life. Maybe some of those good things I was getting in the beginning go away. And I just have no way to deal with that stuff. And the only way I knew how to deal with that prior to coming to AA was to pick up a drink or a drug. So if I don't clean house, that'll be an option for me again. So we can sit and marinate in Alcoholics Anonymous and come to a lot of meetings. It's a great beginning. But Bill says in his in the third step, in the 12 and 12, he says it's a far cry from permanent sobriety. And he uses the word permanent. So I can have permanent sobriety so long as I do these things one day at a time, right? So the eighth step for me was, basically, I was transferring a lot of my four-step inventory right onto that list. And the reason why sponsorship is important in all this process is because my ego plays two pitfalls in the eighth and the ninth step. Either I've hurt nobody, right? Or I owe the entire world an amends. I'm an extremist, right? And my sponsor was able, as I wrote down that list, to kind of pick it apart and say, well, do you really need to talk to this person? Would it injure them more if you talk to them? Probably not a good idea. And then we would go down my list, and he would make recommendations of who I should approach and who I should just kind of let go. Leave him alone, right? And then he had the cards, right? I made the cards, the no cards. And, you know, the most important part of an amends for me is sincerity. I go with sincerity, and I go with no expectation of what the result's going to be. None. It's not about getting your forgiveness from me. You know, it's about me cleaning up my side of the street. And, you know, some people continue to have resentment against me, and I can't control that. That's on them, not on me, right? And, you know, in 2010, September of 2010, I was still living with that gentleman in Chatham. I was feeling a little uneasy. One of the reasons why I was going to so many meetings. And I said, you know, I need to move out or do something different. And I was afraid to move because I hadn't got my license back yet. And the train station was really like I could throw a rock and hit it. And I was working in Manhattan at the time. And I was afraid if I wasn't close to the train station, I wasn't going to make it to work. Soon after, I lost that job in Manhattan. Right? It's funny how I look back at this, how things kind of just fell into place. So I came to my sponsor with a list. And one of them was to actually stay where I was living because of convenience. I thought maybe I'd get another job in Manhattan. Another one was living with my ex and my daughter. Tried family in the past. That didn't work. That didn't keep me sober. Or living by myself. And so pros and cons. And I wrote the pros and cons. I gave it to my sponsor. And he was able to look at that from an entirely different angle. And he knew my story. He knew about my grandmother. He knew about the $10,000 that she gave to me that I partied away after we sold the house. Right? I had $20,000+ cash from that sale of the house. I was living in a $400 a month room, and I managed to spend that money in 3 months. Grandma never saw that $10,000 again. Right? And she was alone. She had emphysema and COPD and a lot of health problems. And he said, here's what I want you to do for me. He said, put aside all these other living situations. He said, I recommend that you go down and ask your grandmother for help. I said, what, are you nuts? I said, you know, my grandparents were our financial rock growing up. They helped us out in a big way, me and my mother. And they've always, I was a firstborn grandson, so I was spoiled, right? Forget about this stuff in my childhood when I'm looking at it in a resentful view, right? Before I got here and took inventory, my childhood was horrible, right? But that was just a story I told myself that wasn't reality. I had a good childhood. And you know, so I said, okay. I said, I'll go and ask her for help. And so I did. I sat across from her kitchen table, and I proceeded to ask my grandmother for help. And my grandmother showed me unconditional love. And she invited me to move in with her. She didn't want the money back. She said, no, that was a gift. I don't want that back. I'm still paying that, by the way, to a charity. I think I'll be paying that for a while. That's my sponsor said, you don't get off the hook. He said, that 10 grand is your responsibility, and why don't you pick a charity that you'd like to donate to, and I don't care how long it takes, but start donating to that charity. And I've been doing that for Well, 9 years now. I probably paid it back at this point, but I don't care. Giving is much more rewarding than receiving. And what a whole new outlook on life. And I didn't understand that when I gave my sponsor some pushback about sitting down and asking my grandmother for help. And what I didn't realize is grandma couldn't cut the grass, but I could. Grandma couldn't get up and down the cellar steps to do the laundry, but I could. You know, grandma couldn't do a lot of things because of her emphysema and COPD that I was able to do. And October of 2015, actually back in August, she fell very ill in 2015, August, and was in and out of the hospital. And she was a heavy smoker her whole life. She tried to quit, but she would sneak them. We'd smell it, but grandma's 70 plus years old, so you don't tell grandma what to do, right? and so they tried to clear out her lungs. They thought they got everything out, and she went into a rehab, and then she got bronchitis and pneumonia again. They had to rush her back to the hospital, and finally the doctor said there's not much we could do for her at this point, and she, with social workers and the family, decided to come home on hospice and die in the house. And I remember the scene, the crazy scene of my alcoholic mother and my uncle and my aunt, and the crazies came out of the woodwork, and it was an interesting time. But we were all there to help out grandma and my cousins. And there was a lot of narcotics in the house at the time. I didn't even really have a thought. It didn't cross my mind. I think about that now. I mean, they were giving her some stuff to kind of make her comfortable, obviously. And, you know, the nurse's aide would come in. And it was a Wednesday, October 15th, 2015. I had stepped out just to go to a meeting in Bridgewater. I forgot I had signed up to speak like months back. And I wasn't going to go that day because of what was happening with my grandmother. And I walked in like with 10 minutes to the meeting starting. And they're like, oh, good, you're here. You signed up to speak. I was like, oh, really? Okay. So I did. I shared about current events and a little bit about my story because they know me down there. I went home. I went to go check on grandma. And we all watched her take her last breath. And I'd say thank God for the amends process, because without that process, I wouldn't have a chance to be a good grandson for the last 5 years of her life, and build upon a relationship. I remember getting an alert on my cell phone that I had booked another speaking commitment months back that I forgot about in West Orange. And as they were wheeling her body out of the house, the coroner was... I was hopping in my car to drive another 55 minutes to go to West Orange and to do another speaking commitment on the day of my grandmother's death. I didn't foresee that happening. I didn't plan on that happening. And I got to share about what just happened with my grandmother, current events, and share my story. And what a powerful program, you know. And I've had many other amends that went that way. Because there was sincerity, and I was coming out of attitude of love, and not what they can do for me, right? If I'm going into an amends and I'm asking for forgiveness and what they could do for me in the relationship, I'm not ready for the amends. You know, I'm not ready to make that amends yet. You know, it's got to put them out of my mind completely and what they did to me, and resolutely take a look at my mistakes in that relationship, and just kind of mend my part or my mistakes in that relationship. And so because of that, I'm a free man. And I'll just read the 9-step promises, and we'll end it there, right? So it says, page 83, bottom of 83, if we are painstaking about this phase of our development, right? So the 9-step amends process is just a phase of my development, right? We will be amazed before we were halfway through. Often when I hear the 12 steps, 12 promises of AA, I always thought at the sixth step, I would be amazed. before I was halfway through. But that's not true. Really what it is, halfway through my amends process, I will be amazed, right? I'm going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. Freedom from people is a great freedom. Freedom from what they think about me and validation from them is a great freedom. We will not regret the past, nor will we shut the door on it, right? So my past becomes an asset in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? I remember where I came from, so I can share where I came from and share what I'm like today to give a newcomer hope, right? We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Again, lose interest in self and gain interest in what I could do for others, right? The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but they will always, always materialize if we work for them. Right? And so if I'm willing to do some things that go against my very nature, which is inventory, confession, and restitution, which are the three legs of those steps, 4 through 9, right? Inventory, confession, restitution. If I'm willing to do those things, then I begin to receive these promises. I think it was our co-founder, Dr. Bob, who actually was afraid of making amends because of his reputation as a doctor. He was afraid that he would lose standing within his community, not be able to afford to feed his family. But everybody knew that Dr. Bob was a drunk. It was no secret, right? And that's the one thing he told Bill he would never do. And he got drunk again. And I think it was coming off of his last drunk the day after, the morning of. It was really close from his last drunk. That he finally went out. He went out to the community and made restitution, knocked on doors and made amends. And from that day, he never had a drink again. What a coincidence, right? So, must, requires, really in the language of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, sometimes differs from the fellowship. I think we do that not to scare the newcomer, right? We don't say must and requirements in the fellowship because we don't want to scare anybody off. But the truth is, when somebody is ready to actually have this solution, there's absolutely nothing somebody can say in a meeting to scare them away. Nothing. Mm-hmm. If you truly and want to be rid of liquor for good and all. Mm-hmm. Right? So that's far more than enough from me, and I'll turn the rest of the meeting over to you guys. Thanks for allowing me to come out and share. Thank you.